Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature, a Tribe Family Channel production where we talk with authors, publishers, movers and shakers in urban literature. I'm your host, Michelle Berard, founder and CEO of Urban Book Editor, LLC. And I want to give a big shout out to Ms. Beverly Black and Tribe Family Channel and the entire network of thought-provoking shows that appear on that channel. Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature is a Tribe Family Channel creation sponsored by Urban Book Editor, LLC, and Hosea and Tensley Brooks, creators of the Play Align series of books, and our guests for the February 2nd show. If you missed that show, check out the replay online. Just visit Tribe Family Channel and look for the on-demand shows. Now, tonight's guest, a lot of you already know, he is just fabulous, and I am super excited to have him on the show. I know a lot of you guys are already familiar with Ed Sewell and his work, but let me tell you a little bit about him. National best-selling and award-winning author Ed Sewell has written over 20 novels and has had his work featured in several anthologies and magazines. He has won literary awards for the novels The Flip Side of Money, Keisha's Drama, and Maya's Choice. In addition, the American Library Association placed several of his teen titles on its widely distributed reluctant readers list. Sewell is a voiceover talent and has narrated several books written by other writers and has done voiceover work to promote products and inspirational videos. He earned his Bachelor of Arts from Columbia College in Chicago and has a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Goddard College. Earl is also an endurance athlete, as if the rest isn't enough, right? Also an endurance athlete who has finished several marathons and Ironman, it was 70.3 triathlons. I don't even know what that is. That's like crazy, fancy, strong people stuff. And he's also completed a cross-country bicycle tour from Red Wing, Minnesota, to Bar Harbor, Maine? What a lunatic. Oh, my God. So, with no further delay, let me welcome Earl Sewell to Love, Lust, Lovers. Welcome.
Thank you. That's funny. Yeah, 70.3, just for clarification, Ironman 70.3 is only half the distance. So it's 140.2 is the full distance. And just so you know, that's in mileage. So the 70.3 is, you know, I'm doing 70 miles in one day between the swimming, biking, and running. So it's a 1.2-mile swim, a 56-mile bike, and then a 13.1-mile run. But I'm working
Holy
up
moly.
The
full.
I'm
Holy
working
moly.
Up the full, which is just double those distances. I know. But
just want you to know, you've already blown my whole excitement for the week because I got to the gym and did, you know, a mile on a treadmill three times this week. You're totally bumming me out. I feel like such a wuss right now.
I don't want to bum you out.
You have succeeded in bumming me out, and we haven't even talked for 4.5 minutes yet. I just want you to know.
Okay, I'll bring you back. I'll bring you back.
Well, I mean, I am so excited to have you on the show, and I'm going to tell you why, because, you know, you are such a versatile writer, and you happen to be an Ironman, so, you know, we're not going to even get into that part yet, but you have written young adult fiction, urban fiction, and your novel that's due out, what, next week, I think it is historical fiction.
Yes.
You know? So you're versatile, but you're also prolific. You have produced more than 20 novels, and that just blows everybody's mind who hasn't done it, right? Some of us haven't gotten one novel out the door yet. How did you start writing?
Yeah, I have a whole lot going on in my brain. It's an interesting place living inside of my head. but, you know, it's a dangerous place. But first of all, before I became a writer, I was a reader. And
okay.
So my love of reading started with my mother. When I was a young man coming up, my mom and I, we would always sit around and read. And so she loved reading classics like The Three Musketeers, Little Women. We read Les Miserables together. We read Moby Dick together. So she started a love of reading for me, and it was our way of connecting and talking about literature and those sorts of things. And so out of that love of reading grew this idea. It's like, wow, that's a good story. I think I could write one like that. And I just started writing. I started journaling. I started keeping a journal because mm-hmm. God didn't want to call it a diary. I started keeping a journal. And with the journal, I started putting short stories in the journals, and, you know, I just, you know, kept them going. And, you know, eventually the short stories started turning into, well, let me take a shot at writing a novel. And then I had a couple of attempts at writing a novel that really didn't go well. So for writers who, you know, say, oh, I've started, I stopped. Yeah, I did that too. But eventually I came across a really good, strong storyline and plot that I was passionate about, and I was able to get through and finish it. And that book became Taken for Granted, which was one of my first books.
Okay. And when was that published?
Oh, I'm going to date myself here. It was first published in 1999 as a self-published book. As an independently published book. And then it was picked up by a major publisher in 2001 and reissued in 2002. And the rest, as they say, is history, because out of that work of literature, I was able to continue getting contracts to write more and more books. And it was great, because I had so many stories to tell and so much in me that, you know, needed to be expressed. And then you know, when I went back to do a master's degree, I finished the master's degree in 2015. So this is real recently that I went back and did the master, and I studied writing even more, in a community of writers, and I came into the program already published. And so what the professors there and instructors did, they helped me to grow and to expand even more. So in the program, I became, in my opinion, an even better writer because I was exposed mm-hmm. to writers from around the globe. And I really looked at writing differently. So I learned about writers from India, writers from Africa, writers from Australia. I mean, just a really writers from the islands that I had never heard of here in the States, but I got exposed to them and learned a lot about how the human condition is so timeless. No matter, and as writers, you know, we tend to write about the human condition and those things that we have to deal with as human beings and the lessons that we learn from them and how we get through them. Is what makes reading so much fun because we can see ourselves in the dilemmas that the fictional characters may be in. And we put ourselves in that and we try to figure out how we would have handled it, or we enjoy the journey of watching someone else get through the complications of the fictional life that, you know, oftentimes, you know, there's a fine line between fiction and reality. And so, you know, and so when you walk that, you know, fine line, sometimes fiction can feel so real. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you have to remind yourself, this is fiction. But then again, you have to say, well, is it?
Yes. Yes. So let me ask you then, you've written all these different types of books. What's your favorite genre to write?
You know, right now, since I'm kind of like in a historical fiction kind of thing, I'm mm-hmm. finding that to be very, very fascinating as a black man in America, and going back and telling the stories or the types of stories that should have been told 100 years ago or that we have the Harlem Renaissance and all of that, but still, you know, ironically enough, the Harlem Renaissance, a lot of the books that were published there were for primarily a white audience because during that time, most black Americans were illiterate. They did not know how to read. Mm-hmm. And so, but that did not mean that they did not have stories to tell and things to share. And so it has been a real journey for me to go back and try to capture some of what was lost with our American experience here, but told from our perspective and not told from the perspective of someone coming from the outside looking into it. And, you know, just like, for example, one of the things that you may not know that actually happened in history is that in the late 1800s, the United States Army commissioned a group of black cyclists. And these black cyclists... These black cyclists, Spalding Bicycles sponsored them, and these black cyclists rode up the United States. The idea was that they were trying to figure out a better way to have transportation during times of conflict. And so since bicycles were a relatively new technology, they thought it would replace a horse. So these men became some of the first endurance athletes around, and they bicycled across the United States. And that's a little known historical fact. And it's like, wow, you know, to take that sort of story and tell it, you know, have mm-hmm. some of that wonderful, truthful history in there, but then to create, the fiction out of that. And, you know, kind of like Black Panther, to take some of the actual truth about culture and fashion and things that, you know, are actually exist in Africa, but then fictionalize it into this world of Wakanda. So that's why mm-hmm. I say, you know, it's really exciting to write in this genre. But of course, I still love writing young adult. I still love writing mainstream fiction. I really love to tell a great story. And in my opinion, if you can tell a really good story, it doesn't matter what genre it is in or what time period that it takes place. It's if it's really good storytelling and it speaks to that thing of the human condition, it's timeless. Like Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, it's timeless.
Although not my favorite Charles Dickens.
No, not your favorite Charles Dickens. Okay. But,
no, you know what? You know what? Everybody's got their favorite something, their favorite Shakespeare, their favorite Charles Dickens, their favorite Zane, whoever. You know what I mean? But
yeah. Everyone has their favorite. But again, you know, even if you look at, you know, Herman Melville's, you know, Moby Dick. I mean, you know, dealing with a complex character, or August Wilson's Fences, the play Fences.
Yeah.
The story of that, and you know, having such a complex man that you know I think with the character there, everybody could relate to him. Even in Baldwin's Native Son, there's just something about really good literature that just sticks with you. The storytelling,
right,
and the lessons learned out of it. There's just something about it, and when a writer takes the time to really understand the craft and really understand human behavior, the human condition, human history, it becomes such a part of you that you know, or at least it has become such a part of me that I can't explain. It's like I have to write, and even right now I have competing characters talking about it's time to write my story. It's time to write my story. So I have about 4 books going in my head right about now.
Wow. That's awesome. Well, actually, now something you said, I have 2 questions, and they're kind of related. The first one is, what makes a good story?
What makes a good story? I think, first of all, you have to have a character that readers care about. And they have to be dealing with something that is keeping them from getting what they need or what they want. And it has to be worthwhile. For example, things that I don't like to write is predictable stories or cliche stories or stories that the reader's like, oh my God, I could have predicted this, or have a reader say, oh my God, Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles could have predicted this story. I mean, because you can, because it's so cookie cutter or so, plain and simple. So I think a good story takes the reader on a journey that the reader does not expect, where the reader says, okay, I think I have it figured out, but then something else happens and you're like, wow, okay, I didn't see that coming. Now what? Also, a good story gets a reader emotionally involved. So the writer has to know how to pull on readers' emotions through the written word. So when you become emotionally involved in a book, that's when you find yourself, you know, trying to go to sleep, but you can't go to sleep because you're trying to finish one more chapter. And then when you get to the end of that chapter, you're going on to the next chapter. The next thing you know, it's 4:00 in the morning, and you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe I stayed up all night reading this book.
Been there, done that, bought the T-shirt.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think when a writer can do that and you know, have, you know, some of those basic components, I think that makes for a really good storytelling.
Well, Earl, you said something else that now I'm going to hold off on my other question for a second, although that's actually, these two are related, so I'm going to ask you. You said that the character should have something that's keeping him or her from getting what they want, and that what they want has to be worthwhile. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because my other question was related to kind of that concept in a way. Like, my question is, well, who decides what's worthwhile? And the reason I ask that is because I have seen I have read where other writers, African writers, African American writers, have gone into graduate programs and have been presenting their work, and they've had professors, white professors, say things like, "Well, that's not realistic," or "I'm not buying that. That doesn't seem realistic." And one in particular I remember was this this African writer who her white professor didn't buy that. They basically said her life was invalid because she was writing from the perspective of a, I guess, middle class or upper middle class African person. And they had cars.
Chimamanda
I think that's who it was.
Yeah, Chimamanda Adichie Ngozi.
Yeah. So, and so, you know, it was like, "Oh, I'm not buying this." And she was like, "I don't know. That's how we live in our house." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We have cars. We have, you know, a maid that comes in and helps my mom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, that gets to me to be the question of two things. One, who decides what's worthwhile? Because that may be a separate question. What's worthwhile for the character to go after? Who decides that, number one? But number two, what about when you're writing and there are these people who just don't understand, particularly as writing from African-American perspective, don't get the culture. And so, you know, they're this is unrealistic. This doesn't work. This is a bad story.
Right. So I'll answer that the way Chimamanda answered it. And she calls it the danger of the single story. This is why Black Panther is getting such an emotional connection with an audience, because we get to see a different story of Africa or a different perspective. And so when you mm-hmm. have people who don't understand, you know, something culturally, it's because they've been fed a single-sided story. And generally mm-hmm. that story is of a stereotype. And it's not that stereotypes are untrue. It is just that stereotypes are not the full story. So, but mm-hmm. you can get a perspective of a stereotype and it's magnified. And then, you know, people just believe that that's the whole story of just that narrow vision of a stereotype or a particular behavior of a culture. And so when mm-hmm. you have someone or a culture for generations after generations who's been fed a single-sided story of just, this is the way this is, this is the way this is, when you present something that is in conflict with the story that you've been fed to, you know, consciously and unconsciously, when you are fed something that is in conflict with that, that causes psychological pain for people.
Mm.
Because now they have to go through a process of unlearning. For me, with the graduate program that I went through, I even had to go through that as I began to read African writers or writers from India. I knew nothing about them except for what Western civilization has told me about it. What Western civilization has told me about, you know, people of Asian cultures, that, you know, they're gifted in math or, you know, they're great martial artists. That's the single story. But then mm-hmm. when you go and you read, you know, Amy Tan's Joy Luck Club, or, you know, someone, you know, from that background, and you get their perspective of their way of life told through their eyes, well, then you get a different side of that. And you're not being spoon-fed. I mean, even as African-Americans in this country and with our society that we've been struggling through, you know, media and other places, you know, for so long, they've been told a single-sided story about people of African descent in this country. Even down to the, you know, for generations, they were told that. And so when you have, like, the wonderful event of, you know, Barack Obama being elected president, that caused psychological pain for a lot of people, because that wasn't story or the narrative that they were told. And then the funny thing about the human condition or the human brain is when you are presented with evidence that is in conflict with what you've been taught, 9 times out of 10, it's safer for you psychologically to hold on to what you've been taught instead of embracing something that's new. And so you know, who decides, you know, what's a good story? Well, for too long, it has been decided by people who have a narrow-minded vision, who only wanted to show the world in a particular light, and it was from a particular perspective. And so that is why it's so important for not only people of African American descent, but people around the globe to have the ability to tell their own stories and to tell them in their fullness and richness and all of their wonderfulness, so that we understand that, you know, that a problem that's happening in an urban city in America can be happening in another place halfway around the globe in a Chinese community. And then that's what I talk about, the wonderfulness of the human condition. We're all human, and the last time I checked, this is the only place we have to live is on this planet. So, you know, until we can get off planet, we are all here together. And, you know, who's to say that your story is better than this story, or, you know, this story is better than that story? No, they're all good stories. It's just, you know, how it's presented and how it's told. But, you know, you don't tell somebody that your story's not valid because from my narrow vision, I can't envision that. Matter of fact, that's what they told George Lucas when he wrote Star Wars. And look what happened.
Yeah, look what happened. A whole couple of generations of geeks later.
Right.
And I am one of them.
Right. And so that's the thing with our world and even our history. When we look at the version of history that Westerners are taught, it's a very watered down version of history. It is a convoluted version of history. And then by the time you start, and then we even as adults have to unlearn the history we've been taught. That's why another movie like why Hidden Figures was so big.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there you have it. I mean, and I think we're in a stage now, especially as the world becomes more connected technologically and more people have a chance to produce work and tell work or to showcase, you know, storytelling and narrative. It just opens the world up to get like, wow, I was never told this. As a matter of fact, I have friends who are teachers in the South today. And one teacher in particular told me that the only history that they get down there that has anything to do with African Americans is Martin Luther King. That's it. So you have a generation of people who are not from our culture that only knows one thing about it that's been taught, and that's by design.
Right.
So there you go. So I'm getting off my Black Power thing now.
Oh, but you know what? You know what? You're like preaching to the choir here. you know, so I'm gonna. There are a couple of things here. One, growing up down south, you are 100% correct about that. I notice that friends from New York, friends from California, they get a different type of education, particularly out here in California, because, you know, I mentioned that I reload out here. There is a really interesting, I mean, yeah, it's kind of a nanny state, but there is a really interesting educational dynamic here. And I feel much better about my son's education out here than in Georgia. But I didn't go to public school. I went to Catholic school. So I actually had, for many years, went to Catholic school. And so I think I had a little bit broader education than, you know, my cohorts in public school at the time did. I think the educational system does a lot of disservice to us, but it's interesting to see how it's different from place to place. But I mentioned being from Louisiana because your character here in this book that you are releasing soon, on the 24th, right?
Yes.
These are fair-skinned people, not unlike our folks down there in New Orleans, a lot of our folks down there in New Orleans, who are they are concerned with keeping the color in the family, as we say. Tell us the premise of this. Tell us about this book that's coming out, because I am fascinated by this story. I started listening to it. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. So tell us the premise of this particular story.
Sure. Lenny Gray is what I found is that let me get it right. So one of the things that I also do is I teach. I teach literature at the college level. And so sometimes on the side I've taken on clients who write memoir. And so whenever I teach memoir, I tell the writers, think about 150 years into the future. What would you want the future chapters of your DNA to know about this chapter or this period of your life? Of the DNA's life. And so I also asked him, how far back in your family history can you go? Can you go back 50 years? Do you know who the people were that lived? And, you know, well, can you go back 150 years, 200 years? What about 300 years? And most of us can't go back that far and know who those people were. But what we do know is that somebody lived and they did not get taken out by disease. They did not get taken out by war. They did not get taken out by accident, you know, or animal mauling. Somebody lived, and we don't know who they were. So I ended up deciding, when I decided to write Lenny Gray, I wanted to dig into my family history.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and did the DNA ethnicity test through Ancestry.com.
Oh, okay.
And so when I did the ethnicity DNA test through Ancestry.com, a whole lot of stuff came back. Because when you shake that family tree, you know, some stuff comes back that I'm like, wait a minute. So there was the part of it, there was the myth that we had Indian blood in our ancestry. Well, when I checked that, there is no Native American nowhere. It is West African and European. And so then I was like, well, where did they get this narrative? So again, you know, going back, you know, I'll come back to that. So going back to Lenny Gray spawned out of the fact that my father is the baby of 18 children.
Wow.
My grandparents had 18 children. And so out of that 18, only two are living today. And that is my father and his sister, who will be 86 this year. And so when I started like saying, well, let me look into the family history, I started saying all these people and names that I did not know. And so then I realized, well, wow, the people who live that, they're gone. I don't know their stories. I don't know what happened to them. And so I interviewed my aunt, who was 86, and out of that 18 children, she's somewhere in the middle of that. So there were children who came long before her. And so through her experience, because she was born in the 1930s, I was able to pull out information about what it was like growing up in the South, in the heart of Jim Crow and segregation. I mean, you know, she was really gracious, and she really let me know what it was like. And so out of what she was able to tell me about the family history, I then decided to construct a fictional story called Lenny Gray, and to follow a family for 30 years from 1918 to 1951. And so one of the things that it helped me, because it was not only a creative journey, but it was a spiritual journey, and it was a journey of seeking understanding. Because, as you know, for example, when slavery ended, there was no psychological help for people of color. There was nobody to say, okay, you know, let's help you deal with, you know, the fact that you were raped, or the fact that your family was split up, or the fact that you've lost children. There was none of that. So we as a people had to figure out, you know, how do we move forward? And so when I did Lenny Gray and I really looked at what it meant to have that many children, and then I realized you cannot be there emotionally for that many people. You cannot be there financially, or they couldn't be there financially for that many people. They couldn't be there spiritually for that many people. There were so many areas of lack that came out of that. And there were so many levels of oppression that came out of that. There was so much that would make us today just crack and crumble. But we didn't. And so Lenny Gray follows this particular family through from 1918 to 1951 and follows them through American history and the things that happened. For example, there's a chapter about the Great Flood of 1927 that wiped out a lot of Louisiana and the South.
Mm-hmm.
There is the Spanish flu pandemic that hit 100 years ago that the flu became airborne, and if someone sneezed and you breathed the spores, it would kill you in 24 hours. And now keep in mind, also during 1918, African Americans couldn't go to a doctor.
Right.
If you got sick, you know, it was like herbs and roots and whatever they could to try to, you know, help you out. And so it marches forward through in time where, you know, you see things like the Harlem Renaissance happening there. You see things like one of the scenes in there is like when the movie Gone with the Wind came out and how a lot of white Southerners loved the movie Gone with the Wind, but how it portrayed black people.
Right.
You know, in that book, you know, and credit to Hattie McDaniels who played, you know, Mammy, she won an Oscar for her performance in that.
Right.
But, you know, and talks about, goes forth through the Joe Louis fight and what Joe Louis meant to not only America, but to black people at the time. It's like what Barack Obama means to us in our time. Joe Louis meant that, you know, you follow me, in his time.
Yeah.
And so you see where these people are as they're trying to move through life and as American history is happening around them. And it is really a fascinating story, not only from a perspective of my journey into my family history, but from the perspective of, I understand how we got here now. From an emotional perspective and a psychological perspective and a financial lack perspective. I mean, a really deep, intimate understanding where it's like, okay, I get it. You know, I know how to break, you know, particular cycles because I've done the introspective work. I've done the journey. I've looked into it. And out of all of that tragedy, I brought forth something creative. And hopefully through that journey of me telling this story, other people will say, oh, my goodness, Danda, I understand, how a black man can get so frustrated and he has no sense of himself and how, you know, he ends up abusing and hurting the ones that he loves the most and the ones that love him the most because he's underdeveloped. He struggles to understand and how, you know, how a woman, you know, in that time, you know, in 1918, 1951, there was no such thing as birth control. So every time that you had a relation with your husband, you ran the risk of having a child. And then not all the children lived. So, you know, so there are so many different dynamics that I don't think a history book can tell you or a history book can capture the way that historical fiction can capture some things because it really gets you into an intimate position with the characters. Well, I know that was a long answer, but I hope that was
no, that's an amazing answer. And I understand that because history books can tell you about something, but fiction helps you, well-done fiction helps you feel something.
Yeah, helps you experience it.
Helps
you to experience it. Helps you to experience. And so that's what I mean, you know, when I said earlier that historical fiction at this point is I'm just truly fascinated by this genre, because there are others who also do historical fiction, you know, exceptionally well. And then not even only historical fiction from an American standpoint, but from a global standpoint. I read a book, Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda. When I read that book, I knew nothing about Nigerian history. I knew nothing about Nigeria. I knew absolutely nothing about Nigeria. But I knew nothing about the different tribes that were, you know, having – I knew nothing. But when I read that book, I got so excited that I was like, oh, my God, this is a part of world history that I don't know. And what it did for me is the historical events that she intermingled into her story, it caused me to go to YouTube and Google and look up the actual wars and look up the actual news stories and look at what the facts were. And I was like, oh, my God, what a way to open up your mind. What a way to grow. What a way to get intellectual knowledge, you know. And then, you know, what a way to, you know, to have more things to talk about. And when conversing with people, you know, you have such a different perspective on the world, and you don't have to depend on the Westerner's view of the world. So I mean, it's just fascinating to be able to read historical fiction or read something from a different culture, then at this stage where we're technologically advanced, have the ability to go get information. And get it. Like, even when I read South African writers, I didn't know anything about South Africa. It forced me to go learn the history of South Africa because I wanted to know more. I was like, wow, what a phenomenal people that came from the continent of Africa.
Right.
Just phenomenal people and cultures that our civilization or our society has only given us one image of. And that's poverty, sickness, and starving children.
Right.
But anyway, so Lenny Gray is my attempt at not only trying to understand my own family's journey, but through the commonality of experience of African Americans, hopefully it helps others to understand what, you know, previous chapters of their DNA history or their family may have experienced, and not just from a perspective, oh, slavery happened, and then there was Jim Crow, and then there was the KKK. No, there's more to it than that. And you know, while we're on the subject of historical fiction, especially African-American, I would encourage your listeners, at some point in your lifetime, visit the African-American Museum in Washington, D.C. It is life-changing.
Wow.
It is a life-changing experience, because as I was doing research for the book, I visited that museum so that I could really, really understand and see the propaganda that was spread, and to see the dolls that were spread, to see the news flyers that were spread, to see all of this literature that was spread to give you a particular perspective of Black people and how we created our entire society around that. And we're still struggling with that to this day, we're still struggling with that because we're trying to break that image, trying to say this no longer applies. This has been a lie. It has always been a lie, and we're tired of you listening to your lies. We're tired of listening to the lies. And I think if we don't want to say it in you know, a violent way, we're just saying we want to shine truth here. Truth. And it's time for truth. Sorry, but it is time for truth. The lies have lived for hundreds of years. There you go.
Well, truth will out eventually, right? Truth eventually always wins.
Yeah.
At least that's what I hang my hat on. That eventually truth will come out. Hey, let me pause for a second here. Looks like we might have a caller, area code 404, Scenic Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Do we have a caller at 404 who would like to ask a question or make a comment?
Yes, you do. Hello.
Hello, caller. What's your name, or if you want to share your name with us?
My name is Raquel.
Hi, Raquel. You have a question for the author?
Well, basically not so much of a question, but I just wanted to say that I appreciate the knowledge that you're expressing to us.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Well, thank you so much. I think it also, I agree with you. It is much needed. And again, it's about growth and learning. It's about feeling pride in who we are. And you know, I think for so long we have had a shared commonality of experience that we are less than. And that just can't hold true. That is just not true. We can only feel less than if we feel it within ourselves. And when we break that within ourselves, then we change not only ourselves, we change our family, we change the world. And one of the tools that helps us to break that within ourselves is to be able to see us, you know, in literature and film and plays and media, is to be able to see ourselves differently. That's my comment.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, Raquel, for calling in and listening.
Thank you, Raquel.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, Earl, you mentioned something, and I'm going to go back to that because you said about seeing ourselves. We've had that kind of theme. We were talking about Black Panther. We were talking about seeing ourselves in literature. And there's some argument out there, you know, I think between mainstream, what you might call mainstream authors or mainstream writers and urban authors, particularly urban authors who write more what you might call street lit, right? Mm-hmm. And that debate is, does it serve us to see ourselves in street lit, you know, to see those stories reflected as well as what you might call historical stories that are more, maybe more accurate to the condition that we came from, or mm-hmm. even aspirational lit, if you will, or movies and so forth. What's your thought on that?
You know what? My thought on it is, if we have the ability to tell the story from our perspective, and if the story teaches us and, you know, helps propel us forward, then I say all for it. Yes, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, what I will say is, if you write the urban literature, don't fall into the trap of selling a stereotype. Don't fall into the trap of selling a stereotype. If you want to write about the human condition of living in an area where there's scarcity and lack, and you have generational poverty that comes out of scarcity and lack, and you're trying, and your characters are trying to navigate their way through this world, or through this fictional world that you live in, that's fine, you know. But you know, don't sell the stereotype, because we've always been sold the stereotype. Go beyond that. I mean, a stereotype is not that it isn't true, but again, it isn't the only story. And again, you know, don't sell it just for the purpose of, you know, trying to, you know, hit a particular audience. Sell it to help somebody grow, to help them become. Because one of the things that I say about literature that is very important, I think, for people to understand, when you write something and you ask someone to read it, you are asking that person to give you permission and access to their mind. Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very important position. It's a privilege to have access to somebody's mind. And so when you realize that, when you're writing literature and, you know, somebody picks it up, you're getting access to them in a way that nobody else can, because it's your voice to their mind. It's your characters to their mind. And you're taking up mental real estate there. And so be mindful of that. when you, you know, if you write the urban literature and you're selling that, understand, are you putting something out there that is going to grow somebody's mind or provide a different level of understanding? Are you going to be able to understand that poverty breeds mental illness? That you now you understand why Uncle Joe or, you know, Aunt Sally may have been this way, or why, you know, Aunt Betsy was always at the church praying for people. You know, even though she was broke and didn't have any money, you know, she still had her faith to lean on. You know, do you understand, you know, the sacrifices of that? Because, you know, generational poverty is hard to break because that's what's modeled for you. But don't glorify generational poverty and then throw in, you know, drug dealing and, or whatever the case may be. You know, and if you have to do it, you know, is there a redemption? Is there a redemptive quality in there? Give me something that I can say, this was an amazing experience. I did not anticipate that from this storyteller's mind, because there's a book out now called Hillbilly Elegy, that's a New York Times bestseller, where they're talking about the people in the backwoods of Kentucky. And, you know, if we take that and say, okay, there's an urban lit for, you know, for that particular demographic. But the way the story is told, it is told in such a way like, wow, you get why, why a certain segment of the population feels the way it does. You get it.
So, I'm going to give you a little bit of pushback here, and I'm going to tell you why. What about the concept of just pure fiction? Do black people not get just pure fiction? Like, we just want some made up stories. You know, white folks have stories about gangsters. They have stories about, you know, all these different other kinds of characters, and that's okay for them. Do we not get that? Is there a reason that we, all of our stories have to be, you know, there's a lesson and there's some redemptive quality, you know, whatever, whatever. Is that necessary for our stories as opposed to, you know, other folks' stories?
Yeah, I think even in other folks' stories, there's always something to be, you know, gained out of storytelling. I think that's the purpose of storytelling. Now, if it's like, you know, do all of our stories have to be, dealing with our social issues? No, absolutely not. They do not. I mean, you can write stories that have magical realism in there, that are fun. You can have stories that, go into the genre of horror or science fiction or there's so many other ways that we can be as creatives. When we be creative in other genres. But regardless, if you create a science fiction story and you're creating, you know, the black version of Buck Rogers, you know, Buck is going to have some problems that he's going to have to deal with, either with personality or other people or the human condition. You can have a guy that's, you know, running around in a spaceship and still have problems with relationships. But the setting or the genre that you're writing in, you're still going to have to deal with the human condition in some way. And again, you know, this guy could be out in space and be having mental breakdowns, you know, based on, you know, maybe they came from, you know, some planet that was, you know, whatever, or they're dealing with, you know, adoption issues, or, you know, they didn't know their mother or they didn't know their father. I mean, the situation doesn't care what color you are. You know, it's a human condition. So, but yeah, I mean, gosh, yeah. I mean, to write stories, I mean, there's some people that have such a unique way of telling a story that, you know, that I cannot do, you know, because I know there's some writers who can write science fiction or fantasy authors, like people who can write like the Harry Potter or the Hobbit or something like, I mean, I wish I could stretch to that point, but that's just not my gift. But, you know, for those who can or those who create movies like The Matrix or something like that. That is awesome. That is awesome. I mean, and I think as writers, you know, as we continue to explore the craft, or if you know, if there's a young listener out there, or somebody that's, you know, getting into it, and they say, well, you know, I haven't seen a black writer write in this genre. Well, then go do it. You be the first. You go do it. Go show the world what you can do. There's an audience for it. That's what I say. It doesn't always have to be a socially, you know, necessarily a socially conscious thing, but, you know, let it be exciting.
Well, and that actually brings me to my last question. We're just almost to the top of the hour. So I do want to ask you, this is Love, Lust, Lovers, late night literature.
Yes.
So talk to me about some of your racier scenes in some of your books.
Sure. So of course I have, you know, intimacy in humanity is nothing new. I remember in one of my novels that I think it was Taken for Granted, where I had to get to the romantic scene or the love scene, if you will. And I remember struggling with that because I was sitting there saying, okay, should I just, you know, say, okay, they made love and that was that. And then I thought, if I went to see Star Wars and it got to the point where, you know, Luke was fighting Darth Vader and it just said Luke won, and you didn't see Luke get his hand chopped off, and you didn't hear him say, Luke, I am your father, you know, would that have been the same experience? And the answer was no.
No.
So the answer was no. And so I remember, you know, having fun and being creative. I said, well, this was my opportunity to show physical activity in a very creative way, and not writing sex just for the point of shock value or just writing sex, because I think, you know, everybody. You know, get the sex, you know, we can sexualize men and women, you know, mm-hmm. We can do that. You know, our society has mastered that. But you know, with the racier scenes, you know, I have been guilty. I will admit I have been guilty of, you know, sometimes just, you know, being out there and writing some, you know, really, you know, explicit stuff for the sake of writing explicit stuff. But I would like to think that as I have matured, and, you know, I come to understand, you know, the explicit stuff is good when it's done well. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it's done well and it has the emotional and mental and time and, you know, other components, you know, the tension and the wanting and the longing and the lust in there, when it's done right, it can be an amazing experience for the reader to go into this world and you know, feel, you know, what these characters are going through and their emotions. And so, you know, I like to have stuff that's really well done. And so I even, and you know, it's funny, it's like the guilty pleasure, right, when you read erotica. So,
yeah.
You know, and so you know, I have, you know, a ton of erotic books that, you know, I find my guilty pleasure in reading from time to time. I'm like, ooh, I think I want to read something racy.
So who's your favorite writer of erotic books?
Oh my God. I don't have a favorite. I know there's this one book and it's supposed to be this memoir of this guy that went around the turn of the 20th century and hung around with people like Harry Houdini and the captain that sank the Titanic, and was writing about their sexual exploits as they were told to him. And I was like, really? So So, you know, wow. You hear things of like, yeah. And so there was, there's this other book. I can't think of the name of it. I think it's on my iPad. But it was this wonderful story about this English professor who was helping this person who, this wonderful man who did not speak English. And she ends up saying, okay, he was wealthy. And she says, well, you know, if you help me with this, I'll help you with English. And they had themselves a little hot little time in there. it's like I really like when I get a full story in there. I really like it when I'm like, ooh, you know, or the language. And because I'm a lover of language, but when you're writing erotica and you have the right language, you have the right sort of flirtatiousness and the right innuendo with mm-hmm. it. For example, I don't know if you know, there back in the 1930s there was an actress named Mae West who stole a lot
yes.
from black women. Okay, and
yes.
so Mae West was a master at innuendo, and so
yes.
she would have lines like, "It's not the men in my life; it's the life of my men."
Right.
You know?
Yes.
And I was like, oh, okay. And so, you know, you get the innuendo and you're like, okay, all right, keep talking that stuff. Keep talking that. You're going to have to pay up. You know, you keep talking that stuff. So I like, for me, I like the fullness and richness of language. When you're writing erotica, I like when you give me the right language to go with it, because when you use vocabulary in a way that is unexpected, but you get it. That's what I like about erotica, because I was like, ooh, I'm going to have to try that. Ooh, I'm going to have to say that. Ooh, that's an interesting one.
So you're getting your pickup lines, you're getting your tone, your love talk.
Yeah, because you're getting all that. And then when you have your partner or whatever, you know, everybody has their little signals. When, you know,
yeah.
they're like, hey, tonight, you know, tonight's your night. And so, you know, wouldn't it be fun if you're reading something and you came up with a new signal or a new phrase or something like that you could come up with where, you know, your partner will be like, wait, what? And then you're like, oh, all right, okay. And then two people are together like that, when they're making love and they're exploring each other, that's our playtime. That's our adult playtime. That's when
yeah.
we get to be kids again. That's when we get to be kids. We get to be vulnerable. We get to have a lot of fun, and it should be fun. I mean, it should be fun. It should be playful. There should be innuendo. There should be all of the touching and exploring and all of that. And it should be done. And it should be fun. I mean, nobody has to say it has to be boring and, you know, it's like, you know, because, you know, sometimes, you know, you may have a partner where you see him come, you go, oh, Lord.
Is that, oh, Lord,
you know,
like, I don't know what to expect? Or, oh, Lord, like,
no,
oh, no.
You know, like, oh, Lord, oh, no, here they come. And then you find yourself having fantasies about somebody else. I wonder what it would be like with this person. Oh, yeah. Okay, you come here. Let me have my fantasy. And so you don't want to look at your partner that you're intimate with and they give you a signal and you're like, oh God, I got a headache. You know, you want to be someone's vitamin and not their aspirin. So.
Oh goodness gracious. Vitamin. That's it, everyone. Listen, you must aspire to be the vitamin, not the aspirin. I think that's good. Quilt that
yeah.
on a pillow, y'all.
Yeah, it's like, you know, oh, look, you don't want to see somebody come. It's like, oh, no, I'm going to need an aspirin after this. You want to have great sex play. You know, you want
mm-hmm.
to have, for example, like, one, you know, in, how do I say it? I think Barack and Michelle have a sexual tension and eroticism about them that is so
they
subtle.
They are a beautiful couple.
So, mm-hmm. It is so hot because when he holds that woman's hand and she takes, I'm like, you know, you just feel it. There's
you know they are in love.
You know that, and you feel that energy with, and then you get, you know, sometimes you get jealous, like, I need to go find my Michelle. you could just tell even the way when they dance together.
Yeah,
you can tell that they were comfortable. was dancing together. Like, if she stepped into his embrace, you know, she was comfortable with, you know, resting her cheek on his shoulder. Or, you know, it was just like you just knew. And when he couldn't sing, but he sang Al Green anyway. It's like when he says, "I'm so in love with you," you just like, you know what? You can't hold a note, but I get it.
That's okay. Listen, I agree 100% with you about that. About that particular first couple, their love was so evident, and I do think that that's something that you strive to see in a good love scene, whether on screen or, you know, in a book. You want to see that not necessarily the comfort, because especially if it's their first time together, there's not a lot of comfort, right? Because you don't know this person, you haven't learned their rhythm yet. But after you've been with someone for that many years, you should you want to still have the crackle, the electricity, but it should be a comfortable kind of electricity.
And not a routine or a boring one. And so one of the things that I know, I've talked to book clubs about this, you know, they're like, well, how do I make my relationship a little more hot? I say, you know, you ever bring the erotic novel to bed and read to each other? Try that. And say, ooh. You know, bring the erotic novel to bed with each other and says, okay, let's read this together. Let's sit up under the lamp and let's read this. Get your little glass of wine, you know, read that. And say, let's read this. Let's go on this mental journey into this together and see what happens. See how far you can get through the love scene before you have to put the book down. okay, them words right there, you need to start practicing. Let's practice.
That's awesome. And for those of you who are thinking that you can't get through an entire book, there are erotic short stories, too. It's not just all novels, right?
Right. Or poetry.
Or poetry.
You can get through some poetry stuff. You're like, what? One of the old school ones that I like is spoken word. Coco Brown, that sundress. I don't know if you ever heard of Coco Brown sundress.
Oh yeah, yes.
Oh yeah, remember that? You're talking about where you looking at sundress? Yeah, buddy.
They still have odes to sundresses in hip hop songs right now. So the sundress has inspired many words.
So when you start having that stuff, you're like, yeah, okay, you know. And it's like I said, it's playful, it's innuendo, it's that subtlety. And for the mature, when you get it, you're like, yeah, okay, I got you, you know. And then and then of course what that does is it stimulates the mind, which is the biggest sex organ, your brain. You know, can you take me there without even touching me? Can you just make me imagine what it's like? And that's what we all do, especially if we're still in the dating arena and we're trying to figure someone out. You know, we look at people and we go right there. We try to imagine what this new lover may potentially be like. But sometimes we're disappointed. But, you know.
In which case, you go back to your books.
Then you say, okay, damn, I just wasted a body count. Okay.
Never a waste, right? You always learn something, even if it's just about yourself.
Yeah, you said never do that again.
Sometimes that's what the lesson is. Yes, sometimes that's what the lesson is. So let me ask you, what is the hottest scene that you have personally written? What book is it in so that everybody can rush out and get it if they haven't got it already?
It would be Taken for Granted, and it would be the love scene on the jet ski in the middle of the ocean. Okay, I'll stop.
Okay, I've been jet skiing once. Recently, because when in Cali, do as the Cali people do. They like that outdoorsy stuff. And I'm having trouble imagining that. I'm going to have to go get that one.
You're going to have to read that one. And you're going to have to say, okay, that was, didn't see that one coming.
I can say, okay, something new.
Something
add
new
to my list of things to try here in Cali, right?
Well, you know, keep that business to yourself.
Well, I mean, the jet ski. Okay, so everybody go out and get Go ahead and get that, because we want the hot scenes. That's what we're interested in.
Right.
So do you have something you'd like to read for us? Oh, yeah, please.
Wait. One more quick thing. I just have to say this because it's funny. You know, blues music is full of innuendo.
It is.
And so there was this I don't know her name, but she's funny. She has this lyric that says, "If you can't cut the mustard, don't bother licking around the jaw." I was like, now that's a line there, man. She was belting out that blues like, "If you can't cut the mustard, don't you bother licking around the jaw, because that ain't." And I said, "Whoa, okay." It's like a bunch. I was like, "Oh, she made her point. Oh, she most certainly made her point."
Yeah. Pretty clearly.
Yes, very clearly. And you said, "Do I have something to read?" You know what? I do not have anything in front of. I don't have anything in front of me. At this particular, if I had known that, I would have had something ready.
Just thought I'd ask. So we're actually, we went over a little bit. I'm sorry. I usually try to keep this really close to an hour, but you're just so much fun.
I've enjoyed this conversation.
You are absolutely fabulous. And so why don't you tell everybody what you've got going on right now that you want them to know about?
Sure. Right now, you know, the biggest thing is Lenny Gray. My next book is coming out this week. I'm finishing up the audio book on. Well, actually, I'm done with the audio book, and so that's just waiting to go on sale. I really like the performance that I give on the audio book. I hired a voice coach to learn how to do that, and as you said earlier, I'm doing voiceover work for, you know, other authors. Which is a lot of fun, bringing literature to life in that way. And then also, you know, I have a young adult book that I'm working on. I have another adult book that I'm working on, and I have another adult series that I'm working on. So you know, I have a whole lot of iron, you know, in the fire. I love the craft of writing. I love the art of storytelling. And to all of those who listen, who've read my work, who've supported me over the years, I appreciate you. I thank you, and I hope to continue to deliver to you great works of literature.
That's awesome. 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 So everybody, make sure that you – and what's the drop date? It's the 24th. Am I right about that of your book?
Yes, it is.
So Lenny Gray is going to be available on the 24th. On Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the likely suspects, all those places?
Yeah.
Awesome.
All the likely suspects, yes. Yes.
And where can people find you online? I know you have a Facebook page, because I'm stalking you there.
You can find me. You know, social media is where I am. I generally, my social media platforms are Facebook and Twitter. And I also have a podcast that you can follow me on, and it's called A Reader's Paradise. And there you will hear me perform works of fiction. And I also do author interviews on there as well. So again, if you have a cell phone and you listen to podcasts, I'm on iTunes and I'm on Stitcher, and pretty soon I will be on iHeartRadio. So again, it's called A Reader's Paradise. And so you can go in there and you can, you know, hear me discuss literature and talk about it and, you know, read works and do all.
Very cool. Very cool. Yes. Well, thank you so much for joining me on Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature. That's our show this week, guys. You can reach out to me online at urbanbookeditor.com or on Facebook and Instagram as Urban Book Editor. Make sure you send me a note. I love to hear from you. Make sure you follow Earl. You will find him on Facebook. He's got his page. He's also got the podcast, so make sure you're following him. Check me out on Somewhere in the Middle, which is my other show that I host. You'll find me at bit.ly/somewhereinthemiddleradio. You can also find the replays at bit.ly/somewhereinthemiddlepodcast. And again, a big, big shout out to Beverly Black, Tribe Family Channel, and all the members of Tribe Family Channel. It is a pleasure. It's an honor to be a part of it. Thank you to our sponsors, creators of the Play Align book series, and relationship enthusiasts, Jose and Tinsley Brooks. And a huge, huge, huge thanks again to Earl Sewell for being with us this evening. You guys be good. Stay mindful. Remain prayerful. And I will see you again on Love, Lust, Lovers, Late Night Literature on Friday. What is it? March 2nd, I think. March 2nd. It's going to be 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, 6 p.m. Pacific. And our guest will be Donna Hill, Essence bestseller. Check it out. Make sure you're here to hear that interview. Peace and blessings, y'all.